Music from First Call, I Sing the Mighty Power of God. And it's 13 minutes past the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and that means none other than Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments joins us now. Don, coming to us from Garden Valley, Texas. He's our resident biochemist. Don, good morning. Happy Tuesday to you.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Don.
I'm hoping you're drying out down there in Texas. I've seen a lot of weather go by. How's it doing?
Oh man. Oh, yeah. Well, we had rain, of course.
No.
Not as much as we've had in the past. Okay. So things are beginning to dry out, and we are seeing some sunshine. Mm-hmm. But with sunshine comes the heat, so our temperatures are climbing.
And probably humid, too, now, huh?
Oh, yeah, very human.
Okay, well, Don, we're always check with Don on weather because he's raising grapes. He's a vigneron. I'm still trying to nail that word down. But he grows grapes and makes now award-winning wine. So congratulations again. You was it a gold medal? What do you call the award here? Was it a gold medal?
Well, it was a gold medal, mm-hmm. in a certain category. Of course, okay. Some of these wine competitions they have different type of categories. I mean, if you're making Cabernet Sauvignon, then there's the Cabernet Sauvignon category. This happened to be the French-American hybrid category because the type of wine was Blanc du Bois.
Mm-hmm.
Which is it actually came out of Gainesville. It's a hybrid between some French grapes and some American varietal to get the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, I guess the real question is, can you recreate that wine now? That was what, 2013 was the vintage.
That's the year that I made it. And
okay.
Yeah, that is the question.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, I do have the recipe, if you will. I mean, I took copious notes and I made a winemaking outline before I started making the wine. So we'll see if we can repeat it again this year.
Now, as a biochemist, would your notes be like all kinds of scientific formulas and things?
No. It's like add so much of this.
Okay. A pinch of this,
at
a pinch of that.
Particular time, yeah. Mm-hmm. and you know, record it, and mm-hmm. you know, it depends on how many, you know, what your juice volume is and how much
sugar
you have.
The trouble recreating that same wine, though, is what that year's grapes produce, isn't it? Because, I mean, how can you be consistent from year to year?
Well, it's difficult, mm-hmm. But you know, the major winemakers, major companies, obviously do it, and they probably do it by blending as well as the type of year it is. Here, we seem to be getting much greater variation in weather because I mean, we haven't had this much rain. It seems like forever, mm-hmm. so. That's been a challenge, so it's going to be interesting to see what the grape crop is going to be.
Okay, well, we'll keep tabs on this and see how this turns out. I'd love to see you get another award, nail one down for 2015, maybe.
That's always been the interesting challenge to me in the wine business is that, you know, there's so much is dependent upon, you know, weather from year to year, and it's never the same.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the basis of the whole thing. How the grape grows and what it tastes like in the end.
Well, some folks think that just the older the wine, the better, but that's not necessarily true, is it? I mean, the year depends upon the weather in that region for that particular winemaker as to whether or not it's what they would call a good year or a bad year.
Well, and the you don't want a white wine. White wines don't age very well.
Okay.
They don't have a very long shelf life, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
it's the deeper red wines that have a right mix of tannins and anthocyanins that you know, could age you know, hundreds of years. But it's interesting, the longer the wine ages, the less time you have to drink it. It goes through, you know, when you first open the bottle, it needs to breathe because it's been aging for a while. Uh-huh. And so you get some little bit of off flavors or aromas. But then you reach a peak after it's kind of oxidized. But it can go pretty quickly after that.
So. Okay. Have you ever sampled a really old wine?
I have not.
Okay.
No, I mean, a 100-year-old bottle of wine.
You read about some of these things, and I'm just curious. That's all. Just curious. Curious, too, about this article we're dealing with. Now, this is a story about dinosaurs, and it comes to us courtesy of Business Insider, which is kind of an unusual source for dinosaur information. It's a business journal, not a scientific journal. But they're dealing with the thoughts of paleontologist Jack Horner, who was involved in the Jurassic Park movie a few years ago, and I presume is connected with this new Jurassic Park movie coming out. And I didn't realize that they've already done things like creating rabbits that glow in the dark. I didn't know that. I have heard about transparent mice, you know, mice with transparent skin that they can use now in research for different things. But Horner claims that if we were interested, we could genetically engineer creatures like these dinosaurs, or like anything else we can figure out a genetic code for, even if it never existed in nature. Is that true, Don? Could we create an original animal of some kind?
That is a far stretch. I mean, we can't. We would not be able to create, an animal from ex nihilo, or at least from nothing, let's say. Okay. We'd have to take the genetic information and the genetic and the DNA, or at least make copies of the DNA, which we're getting pretty good at doing that, kind of splice everything together and hope it works.
I mean, you're talking about a recipe here, kind of like you were describing for your wine here, a little of this and a little of that. If you have enough different DNA versions, can you just put genes together and come up with something original?
Well, let's take the glowing rabbit, for example, as an example. I mean, they took the luminescent the gene for the luminescent compound, and they spliced that in to the rabbit, the natural rabbit genes. But you had a complete animal, and you had the complete DNA, as well as, you know, a host for the DNA, which was, you know, like a the rabbit egg, and of course that has to have the sperm in order to fertilize it. So they had a fertilized egg to begin with, and there's a lot of mechanism that it's not just the DNA that you need.
You can't just start with petri tubes or dishes and Bunsen burners and put something together. You start with an animal to begin with.
Well, exactly right. And cells are extremely complex. They have they have enzymes, for example, very specific enzymes. They have structure to them. There's scaffolding inside the cell. Much like your hair, for example, it's the same kind of type of material that causes either the cells to divide or promotes cell division. Without structure, cell division wouldn't be possible. Mm-hmm. For example, it wouldn't, because you got to pull two strands of the DNA. You got to duplicate the DNA in the first place. And how is that going to be done? Well, that's done with enzymes. It's DNA cyclase unwinds the DNA. I mean, there's just all kinds of materials that you need in order to, turn on the DNA and turn off certain sections of DNA at the right time. Because an egg is fertilized, things start happening immediately. And, of course, with a human embryo and a human egg and a fertilized egg, things happen immediately once the sperm has penetrated the egg's membrane, for example. There are chemical changes in the membrane to shut off any other sperm from entering. Mm-hmm. This isn't just a simple thing of, well, I'm going to take this little piece of DNA and I'm just going to splice it in over here, and I'm going to splice this over there, and pretty soon we can make a creature with any characteristic that we want. It's a far more complex problem, and we haven't solved this by any means. And to think that you can either turn on and turn off certain specific genes and get specific traits, is very, very naive to begin with. And we're dealing with paleontologists here and not necessarily with a molecular geneticist and people who, you know, study. Mm-hmm. Well, this guy, for example, is a paleontologist. Mm-hmm. Some research and some progress has been made in gene splicing, of course, and we use it in the biotechnology field to create or help to create different types of things. I mean, this is what we were mm-hmm. doing at the biotechnology company that I worked for. To go from just splicing in a particular gene which codes for the compound, for example, or the protein of interest, one single protein, is one thing, but to completely alter the genetic makeup of an animal or even of a cell is quite the other thing. Because all of these things work together. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to have the right enzymes and the right structural proteins and a lot of these things. If you didn't have that, then you wouldn't go very far.
David, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the movie guy. Now, in Jurassic Park, wasn't the original idea? Now, this is fiction, but they'd found a mosquito or something trapped in amber.
Mm-hmm.
And right. is that how it happened? So that they opened mm-hmm. it up and looked in there, and then there's DNA in there.
And the interesting part about that too was that there were parts of it that were missing. I remember McCullough, forgotten his first name, Sir Alex McCullough's not the right name, but anyway, he was the movie actor played the doctor in the movie, and he looked inside and he said, "Ooh, look, there's missing pieces."
Yeah, I think his character name was Alan Grant, and actually this guy Jack Horner, the paleontologist, was the inspiration for that character in the movie.
Alan Grant was the young guy. He was adventurer.
Okay.
Yeah, he was running it. I was thinking the old guy, and that's the guy I can't think of his name, and he died last year before. Last year, I think it was.
Okay.
But he's been around for, he was in his early 80s, and mm-hmm. he was the one that invented the park in the story.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, in this article today, Jack Horner, who had worked on that movie in the same year, 1993, that was the year that the first Jurassic Park movie came out, he and then graduate student Mary Schweitzer were working together. Now, Mary Schweitzer has come up in our discussions before because she is one of the scientists who's found soft tissue in dinosaur bones, much like Mark Armitage has. We've had him on the air a couple of times now. And so she was working with Jack Horner, and they did some research, and they tried to extract DNA, apparently, from some of Mary Schweitzer's samples, but they failed, it says. DNA basically starts coming apart as soon as the cell dies, according to Jack Horner. And he said if they went through the procedure they did in Jurassic Park, he said you'd basically wind up with a frog. So, you know, in real life, he said that wouldn't work. So,
well, see, that, and that's what Richard Attenborough is the guy's name. When he looked at the DNA in the mosquito,
mm-hmm.
you know, highly fictionalized science here, but the mosquito trapped in amber then supposedly kept the DNA alive. The mosquito had just bit a dinosaur. And then sucked out some of his blood.
Okay.
So the DNA was living inside the mosquito, inside the amber, but most of it was still there, but they had pieces or gaps in the string.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to use frog DNA to fill in the spots, in the gaps.
Don, is it possible to get DNA from those old samples, you think, for a dinosaur?
Oh, no. No, DNA is... As specified or stated in the article that, yeah, DNA breaks down very, very easily. Even the process of isolating it from a cell, the DNA structure, I mean, it just falls apart. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very long macromolecule, biomolecule, held together by sugar phosphate. To the backbone is a sugar phosphate bond, which is itself not all that stable, Just like I said, just the process of isolating it is very, 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 very difficult and very, very, you know, tedious. Now, you could get pieces, you possibly could get pieces of DNA. And let's talking about Mary Schweitzer and Mark Armitage, for example. Mary doesn't believe that the dinosaur bones, of course, that this soft tissue has been isolated from, is very young. So, you know, she believes that it's, like everybody else, it's 65 million years plus old, depending on the type of dinosaur where you found it. Mark Armitage, on the other hand, believes that, well, you know, these are young. This is, relatively speaking. I mean, we're talking about
thousands of years old, not millions.
Yeah, thousands, half a decathousand, if you will, years old as opposed to 65 million years old. Now, in that scenario, is it possible to get DNA fragments? Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe. The sample that Mark Armitage, a sample of soft tissue that Mark Armitage explored and got him into trouble because he said this is a young, that it's a young young dinosaur, not necessarily a young dinosaur, but a young sample, meaning it's thousands of years instead of millions of years old. You might be able to find fragments of DNA if you were very careful and looked in the right place. Proteins, you can be fairly stable, and they certainly have done immunofluorescent type of probes of certain types of proteins, like on the surface of cells, for example, to differentiate different types of cells. In Mary herself, in their lab, they actually did that and showed that, well, these are bone-forming cells, for example. The way she phrased it in her research papers is it's osteocyte-like, and not proclaiming that they're actually osteocytes, which, of course, Mark says that they are. They've got the structure, they've got everything, to say that they're osteocytes. But whether or not you could piece together, information from those type of samples is highly speculative because, one, you don't know what it's supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. How do you know you're supposed to piece this together with, this piece with that piece? Now, there are some, sticky ends, if you will, on sometimes some of these pieces, but you'd have to almost know the information ahead of time before you could do it. And if you knew the information, you wouldn't necessarily need to go exploring, in extracting, for example, the information from these sources.
Now, looking at this article, he's talking about maybe there being another way to recreate dinosaurs, and that's by starting with something descended from dinosaurs and working backwards, kind of like reverse engineering. And he's talking about birds here. Now, it seems to me, and I'll read this to you, it says, we have creatures on the planet that are direct descendants of dinosaurs, birds. Well, is that an assumption, or do they know that for a fact? And if you ask a paleontologist, birds are dinosaurs.
That's what's being taught. Of course, it's you got to build the evolutionary story, and so not all dinosaurs. They're only talking about the dinosaurs that flew at one, like the
one category,
pterodactyls, for example. The reason why this is a highly evolutionary, driven article, for example. Now it's a popular article in that there's no science. It's all, it's all speculation and discussion. But, you know, some research has been done in trying to, if you will, turn off certain genes for making a bird beak and therefore allowing the expression of genes that would make a dinosaur snoot, for example. And so the story would go is, well, you know, if this creature, if this animal, for example, the chicken, you know, is a descendant from, let's just pick one, you know, the pterodactyl,
okay,
then or the you know, some other snooted dinosaur, then they should have remnants of the DNA from those animals. That's the hypothesis. Now, we know from the Bible, of course, that you know, God created every animal and everything after its own kind. And so what does that mean? It means that every different type of different kind of animal, and I'm not talking about species here, because species they break you know, species down into you could have several different species of an animal and still be the same kind of animal. The best example, one of the good examples, is the dog kind, in which case, you know, we talked about the fox turning into having dog-like characters, and of course the wolf and the dog and all of the variations within the dog, you know, are all of the dog kind. But that's just variation within a kind, and it's not a different, if you will, set of genes.
Not,
although
not surprising, you know, or revolutionary. That's happened forever. Yeah,
yeah, that's happened since God put things in motion, so that, you know, we could look different and things would be more interesting. So, you know, you've got different features than I have, and you know, certain people groups have certain types of major characteristics than other types of people groups. But that's taking the genetic pool and it's actually isolating out certain types of genes, which happens, you know, during the conception process, you know, which genes are going to from the father, for example, are going to mix with the genes from the mother, and to produce, you know, whatever the characteristic the son or the daughter is going to have, the progeny from you know, those particular parents. So that process has been going on for a long time, but to state that, well, you know, from a creation point of view and from a biblical point of view, the dinosaurs that, you know, especially the bones, because that's mainly what we're finding, although we have found, you know, mastodons, whole mastodons and whole animals in the frozen regions.
And these are different than fossils. These are bones. They're not mineralized. They are actual bones.
They're bones, or they're partially mineralized, because they, you know, were trapped in mud and they weren't, you know, buried in a lot of water for a period of time, for example. So they didn't get completely fossilized. But even so, you know, the different dinosaurs are there different kinds? I mean, the Triceratops is different from the Tyrannosaurus Rex, which is different from the raptors, you know, which are, you know, all these different types of dinosaurs that, in quote, aren't living today. You know, those are kinds of animals that, you know, they got lost, many of them, obviously, in the flood. Not all of them, because we have legends in our history of, you know, dinosaurs being, well, for example, dragons in
the dragons is a fascinating topic. I mean, is there not evidence of a dragon-like creature found in Greece and other areas of the world that we still, we found bones that suggest that there were dragons?
Yeah, oh, of course. And there were dragons, and of course we have evidence in the Bible that there were fire-breathing dragons, because God references it when he's talking to Job, you know, and says, can you create one of these? You know, Job has nothing to say, because obviously he can't. So it's interesting that we go back, you know, these folks are talking about doing just that, what God was talking about to Job. You know, it would be like if God came down and says, you know, talk to this paleontologist, Jack Horner, and said, well, can you create this type of animal? Can you create the Tyrannosaurus Rex, or can you create the you know, let's make it easy. Can you create the Velociraptor, for example? Can you create one of those? And Jack would say, well, if it's possible that I could create one. How arrogant is that, you know, to our Creator God, to be able to say something like that? But this is what these folks want to do. They are literally playing God with the information that God has left behind, for example, in the DNA, and thinking that they could ever possibly create an animal that, you know, isn't maimed in some way. You know, a glowing rabbit is one thing, but you know, to try to manipulate you know, genetic information and material in such a way that you're going to create a whole new animal, or try to bring back one from the past, I think is not a very good thing to be doing, but also the theory behind why or how they think they could do it is extremely flawed, as we've talked about before, and that is evolution.
Well, there are teams of scientists working on this. Harvard Yale team is working on converting a beak to a dinosaur snout, and the work goes on, but there are plenty of skeptics out there too who say this won't be easy at all, that it involves yet undiscovered genetics. And sooner or later, I suspect that there'll be another book out, because that's I don't want to be critical of Jack Horner here, but How to Build a Dinosaur is its publisher. It's his book. The extinction doesn't have to be forever. So there are certain assertions and certain assumptions here that I guess make for good literature, but less than good science. And again, not being critical of Jack Horner, because he says, no, it wouldn't have worked the way it did in the movie. And there are lots of problems with this, but still, it's a fascinating area of research. We will link to this article in today's podcast of our conversation with Dr. Don, so you'll be able to read this article too. Otherwise, you can search for it on the Business Insider. It was published about 6 days ago by Kevin Loria, and do your own search and find it. Otherwise, wait for the podcast here. Another couple of hours, it'll be up on our website. You can click a link and then read this article. Got some dinosaur pictures from the movie, some DNA, and you get to see a picture of chickens, and, well, not a lot of whole solid information to go on, but interesting nonetheless.
The thing that, you know, and I read somewhere recently that there's the only thing worse than a pessimistic young person is an optimistic old one. But I still hang on to the optimism. I'm still one of those, the sun will come out tomorrow business. But I find it interesting that the end of the Jurassic Park movie, and I'm not even sure if there was there a series, each one of them, that maybe they created a different kind of critter.
I think this is the fourth one that's just about to
okay,
come out.
The one that's in, and they're all good theater, but they all end in disaster. And just about all of them, the ending, the moral of the story is the dinosaur eats you, or the dinosaur destroys the park. I mean,
there's a lot of that.
And you know, like the movie Network, you know, the Ned Beatty character, says to the main character, you have messed with the forces, the vital forces of the universe, and I will not have it. And that's the theme that I'm getting from the movie, that Yeah, I mean, it's literature and it's highly fictionalized, but that's the moral of the story. And, you know, so far, there is something in us, something within us that won't accept a version that doesn't you agree with our metaphysical being.
Well, we could put this in the category of Jules Verne, I guess. And he wrote 150 years ago, but he talked about a trip to the moon. He talked about a trip to Mars and space travel and so forth. Sometimes I think the literature, even the fictional literature, precedes the science because it stimulates us to do the science, I think. You know, you read this and you get, well, I wonder if that's possible. Let's look into it. And so scientists are working on it. Dr. Don Clark, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, I want to mention Creation Moments to you. They have a wonderful website. It's creationmoments.com. And there you will find a wealth of resources, and most of it scientific, that supports a young earth creationist position. And regardless of what you think about this, I think you'd be fascinated to read that science, whether you're critical or supportive of it, but examine it for what it is as science and see what they have to say. You can click at our website on the Creation Moments graphic over there to the right side of the homepage. It'll take you to creationmoments.com instantly, and you can take a look, both audio and DVDs and a lot of books available there. It's a fascinating website. Dr. Don, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it. It was fun talking to you.
Well, it's a fun topic. I actually years ago I wrote a short article on the Jurassic Park series
and
whether or not dinosaurs could be recreated. So
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, you've said that a lot. Yeah,
is it published somewhere that we can get to it?
Well, it was for Creation Moments, they probably have it in their archives.
Okay.
But of course, I have the original article and on my probably in my computer files here somewhere.
Well, we'll look at maybe finding linking to it as well. We could find it at Creation Moments, imagine, and get a link to it. So we'll take a look at that. Dr. Don, we'll talk to you in a week or so. Okay.
All right. Sounds very good. You folks have a great week.
You too.
As well.
We will do that. Bye bye.
So long.